For nearly 10 years, the journalist Rachel Monroe was collecting stories of women who were obsessed with crime. Women like her. Monroe falls into what she calls these crime funks, where she would read a news story about a horrible murder and it would worm its way into her brain. And she wasn't sure what, but there was something that interested her about this obsession in herself and in others. So last year, when the cable TV channel Oxygen hosted its second annual fan convention called CrimeCon in Nashville, she decided to go.
It was, I think, 80 to 90% women, you know, girls' trips or bachelorette parties, and had that fun, gleeful energy to them. There were a lot of mother-daughter pairs. Some of the men who were there were like very clearly part of a couple and being kind of dragged along. And there are many different panels and talks about unsolved cases. At the same time, you have things like the Wine and Crime Happy Hour, or you have a place where you can take a selfie that looks like a mugshot. You can lie down in the chalk outline of a body and take a selfie there. And so it's this strange mix of fun, entertainment. At the same time, there is just talking about these stories of, you know, serial murder.
And why did you go?
I went because I was curious about this fandom. I was curious about what it would be like to be around a bunch of people who were enthusiastic about crime stories. I sort of had my own speculations about why people were interested, but I wanted to see it in real life.
By her final day, Rachel Monroe writes about how the experience began to lose its magic. She was scheduled to attend one final CrimeCon event. It had a mysterious name, Sensory Experience.
It didn't give a lot of information about what it was, but it did say 21 and up only. And I didn't quite know what that meant. The presenter was talking about a man who had killed a number of women in Florida, I believe, I think it was the 80s. And she was trying to sort of bring more attention to this man's crimes. He had killed these women in a swamp, and so she had a sound effect that made it sound like the swamp. Everybody was handed a little cord and a blindfold, and it turns out the cord was supposed to be a wrist restraint. She told us that as an exercise in empathizing with the victims, we were supposed to put our wrists into these conveniently provided wrist restraints and put the blindfold over our eyes and hold our hands over our head as we were blindfolded and listen to some of this man's writing. And I remember feeling just really, really horrified, listening to this man's words about these terrible crimes that he had committed. Clearly this is something that he got off on, was terrifying young women. And here was this room full of women listening to his really sick fantasies. Somehow this was supposed to be us honoring the victims, but it just felt really sensationalistic and exploitative. I just didn't see how anything that we were doing was helping anything. I don't think there's any benefit in knowing what was going on in his head, really. And I just had this moment where I was like, I can't believe that I'm stuck here. And then I realized, I'm not stuck here at all. I came here out of my own volition. And if I walked into this room and put this blindfold on, I can take this blindfold off and walk out of this room. And that's what I did.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rachel Munroe's new book is called Savage Appetites. And in it, she follows four women obsessed with crime. Four women, she says, who took things a little too far, according to conventional wisdom. She says they were women who used these murder stories as a way to live out other kinds of lives, lives that were otherwise unavailable to them. Munroe is a journalist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, among other places. At first, she said she wasn't sure why she was collecting these stories of obsession.
I have an artist friend who describes it as, you know, there are certain things that you keep in your sketchbook if you're a visual artist. And so I think as a writer, these were just stories that I knew there was something there, but I didn't quite know what. And it took me a long time to realize that that quality that you describe was exactly what they had in common, that these were people who became really invested, in some cases maybe overly invested, in crimes that didn't happen to them. And I think when I finally realized that was a link between them, it also made me think about myself and my own tendency to, maybe not to the extreme extent of some of the women that I write about, but to a certain extent, find myself really connecting with crimes that didn't happen to me, that do somehow in a way, I don't know, they hit me in a way that feels personal, even if there's nothing personal about it. And that can be a force of good and empathy in the world. And it can also lead to, I think, some more sinister things. And I was seeing it reflected in the world, not just in these four stories or in myself, but over and over again. And so that seemed like a fruitful place to start the conversation. And I also felt like that was a discussion I wasn't seeing happening elsewhere. Like, what does our societal obsession with these true crime stories do and mean?
You mentioned having this, I think you describe it as a post-adolescent crime funk. You went through this funk where you were, one of the things you would do is you would take your mom's People magazines and thumb through them, not about the celebrity part, but the killers and kidnappers part. And I wondered, do you think you understand what was it that was drawing you to the stories of the killers and kidnappers then?
Well, that People magazine phase, I associate that with adolescence, with pretty early adolescence. And when I've talked to a lot of other women who also have an interest in the true crime genre, they often trace it back to that period in life, too. And I think that's a particularly fraught period for particularly for girls. If you're growing up as a girl in this culture, you receive a lot of complex and sort of scary messages about vulnerability and desirability and what it's going to be like to become a woman in this culture. And I think those People magazine stories, they felt as though they were giving me a certain, they were telling me about the adult world, something that I could sense was out there, but that the adults in my life were maybe shielding me from or protecting me from. But I knew it was out there. I knew there was some sort of menace and it had to do with sex, and it had to do with violence, and it had to do with victimhood and vulnerability and how all of those things were all kind of mushed up together. And I wanted to know more about it. And those stories felt like they had some lessons that I needed to learn.
It's interesting how you mentioned that in that sort of post-adolescent phase that a lot of the time, the appetite for murder stories was kind of related to your own sense of turbulence that was going on in your own life.
Yeah, totally. And that's and as I got older, I started, and that was a real revelation to me in writing this book and thinking about these periods in my life when I have tended to get drawn in and read those, you know, 500-page paperbacks by Ann Rule or stayed up late at night going down the Wikipedia rabbit hole or the Reddit rabbit hole reading about particular cases. They tended to be periods in my life when there was trouble. There was just some sort of trouble, be it romantic or economic, my job, my home life, felt precarious in some way. And so these stories were a kind of distraction they weren't pure distraction, right? Because they somehow fit into the anxiety that I was feeling and my sense of vulnerability in the world. But they offered kind of a neat story in a way, even as troubling as they were. There was usually a bad guy, right? The problem was a bad guy. And once the bad guy got caught by the authorities, then the problem was solved. And so there was something soothing in that story. When my life would feel turbulent, I would be drawn into and really compelled by.
It's interesting, too, though, that you talk about how your perspective would shift around when you were reading the stories. Like sometimes you were related to the victim. Sometimes you related to the detective figuring out who committed the crime. But there were even the times, and I guess these were maybe darker times, I'm not sure, when you actually saw yourself somehow in the killer.
Yeah, that seemed to me a really key point that came up as I was writing the book, that crime stories in the true crime genre, it's certainly not one thing. It is many different things in many different forms, but it also invites many different kinds of allegiance or identification. And it's so different to read a book or listen to a podcast that invites you to feel like you're in the role of the detective, and that's who you should be sympathizing with or seeing yourself reflected in, versus media that's kind of more fascinated with and preoccupied by the killer. And I think they activate different parts of the psyche, and some of them are reassuring and some of them are less reassuring. And so part of that was me feeling dissatisfied with the way that the genre of true crime was being talked about as if it was one thing. And I could see how these different points of identification really shifted the work that these stories were doing, and how they impacted me as an individual, and also how they impacted the world.
Yeah. I have to say, I think this was a theme that, for me anyway, emerged from the book, was this idea that that this is really complicated. The fact that we've stripped out, as you put, the nuance of some of these stories. But also the other part that was interesting is that there is why women may find these stories interesting is, as you say, sometimes it's just genuine pleasure. And sometimes there's that idea that women like creepy stories because there's something maybe creepy inside of them, which is really complicated. So it seems like the complications here are part of what interests you in the subject.
Yeah, I love complications. And yeah. I think there's a real strong temptation when confronted with something as threatening and dangerous as these stories of crime, which are in some ways about the breakdown of human relations or the breakdown of society, this mutual trust that we have, that we're not going to harm each other when that collapses or breaks down. That's really frightening. And so there's a strong temptation to frame it in a really solid, simplified, reductive narrative that will kind of restore order. You know, this terrible thing happened, but we can tell it in this way that does have in some ways the cadences or a relationship to fairy tales, where there's a good guy and a bad guy, and the good guys get the bad guy in the end. And so even though this terrible thing happened, there's this feeling, at least in the narrative, of a restoration of order. But like you said, the more you look at these stories closely, you realize that leaves out so much, and that really often fails the people who are victims of these crimes, somehow affiliated or associated with or impacted by them, to make that story reductive. And so it seemed to me really crucial to honor that complexity, even if it's uncomfortable, right? I mean, it's uncomfortable to say that these stories are pleasurable, that there is some sort of pleasure derived from listening to a podcast about somebody who was kidnapped, somebody who was assaulted, something like that. That's a hard thing to admit, but I think that if we're honest, we have to at least start with the fact that there is a pleasure, there is an entertainment value that people derive from these stories, and that's uncomfortable. But it's really clearly true, and you'll see explanations where people will say, "Oh no, well," particularly when discussing why women are drawn to these stories, because I think that there's a sense of women are supposed to be nurturing and kind and not have any relationship to violence. So sometimes you'll see these kind of pop psychology explanations, like, "Oh, women are drawn to these stories because." They want to avoid serial killers, and maybe that's a part of the puzzle piece. But to me, that really doesn't account for the enthusiasm, that people express when consuming these stories. And you know, maybe it's not flattering, but we have to just at least acknowledge it, bring it into the conversation. We can't deny it if we're going to really think about how this genre functions and both personally and in a larger societal way.
You do say that part of the curriculum of growing up as a girl is to learn lessons about your vulnerability. I was really interested in that. What do you mean that we're imposing this idea of vulnerability in some way, that you're expected, if you're growing up as a girl in some cases, to feel vulnerable, or did I get that wrong?
No, I think that's right. And in some ways it's a cautionary tale to be safe. But I think a lot about a writer named Alice Bolin, who wrote a book called Dead Girls. And she writes about how often a dead girl is at the center of a piece of pop culture. Often these detective procedurals, they start with the discovery of a young woman's body, often a young white woman. And that's the impetus for the story that follows. And if you just think about how many dead girls that young women and young men growing up in this culture have just consumed through pop culture, you learn that as a girl, you learn that one prominent role for you on television, in the media, one way that you can get attention is because something terrible will happen to you. And it's when you absorb that lesson, those stories as a girl, it really gets in your head. And then, which is not to neglect also the real violence that happens to young women in our culture. And it's just a lot to absorb and to kind of process at a very young age.
Rachel Monroe, her book is Savage Appetites, 4 True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale, host of the Preach podcast. About 9 years ago, a lawyer at Google, Anjali Kumar, set out on a journey to answer the kinds of questions too big even for Google to answer. And on this week's episode, we hear what she found out.
I had just gone to see John of God, and this woman was just looking at me like I was completely off my rocker.
Come get existential with me on Preach. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, the journalist Rachel Monroe is with us. We're talking about her new book called Savage Appetites, where she explores why some people, women in general, herself in particular, are obsessed with true crime stories. You chose the stories of 4 women, and you talk about each sort of represents an archetype. One is about the detective, one is about the victim, one is about the defender, and one is about frankly, the killer. How did you choose the 4 women? I mean, of all the stories that you had been collecting and thinking about, how did you choose these 4?
I wanted to find 4 women who, while they shared that quality of of obsession or identification or over-identification in some cases, they were also distinct. And through that way, they could, through their differences, they could paint a broader picture of some of the complex, multi-layered motivations that draw women to these narratives. And so they span, about a century of history. They span many different kinds of media. And I wanted to find women who were in some ways extreme examples of this. And I think that's partially because extreme examples, they make for a good narrative. They make interesting writing material, but also because I think they can illustrate, they can kind of highlight a pattern. When you look at somebody who is on the extreme or obsessive edge of something, you can see something there that might be more muted in someone like me, for example, who, you know, maybe I'll stay up really late at night, but these stories aren't taking over my life in the same way. And I wanted to write about people who were just a few steps beyond me and see what I could learn by looking at them.
It's interesting. Yeah, they all took it a little too far at times. And the interest or I guess obsession you mention, it always cost them something. And we'll talk about that as we go. But you also mentioned all of them tended to reinvent themselves throughout the process. What is it about that, do you think?
Yeah, it was really interesting to discover that. And some of that was because of the limited roles that they were allowed to occupy in various stages of history. You know, women's mm-hmm. roles were prescribed. And so through attaching themselves to crimes, they could maybe get more prominence, become involved in something that they wouldn't have been allowed to had access to in their own life. And then also, yeah, sometimes I think that these crimes can sort of serve as a metaphor in a way. If there's something that you can't necessarily say about your own life, you can use somebody else's story as a sort of proxy almost. Mm-hmm. I think about that in the case of people identifying with victims. Maybe you have been a victim of a crime, and or maybe just a victim of life, a victim in a relationship and in a sort of unbalanced or unfair relationship in some way that you weren't murdered, but by identifying with somebody who has a sort of more visible wound or pain in some way, you can work through what happened to you in your own life.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a few of these women. Let's start with Frances Glessner Lee, the detective, the all-knowing detective. I guess that's the archetype where she fits. And tell us about her, but maybe start with the dioramas, because this is amazing, I think.
Yeah, they're really incredible. She was best known for these dioramas that she made when she was in her 60s. Yeah. They look like dollhouses. They're very incredibly precisely made dollhouses. So the tiny little pencil will actually write. The tiny little mousetrap will actually snap shut. And so they have all that kind of a obsessive attention to detail that miniatures do. But they're also really uncanny in a way, because in each little dollhouse diorama, there's a dead doll. And the idea was she would get very upset if people called them dollhouses, because to her that implied that they were toys in some way. And for her, they were explicitly not that. They were teaching tools. And she was fascinated with the science of forensics, which when she was growing, she was born in the 19th century. She was kind of growing up as the field of forensics itself was growing. She really wanted to make sure that scientific investigation or that police investigation was scientific, because the concern was that if police were investigating cases just based on their hunches, based on their assumptions, they would be subject to bias, frankly, and stereotype. And so each of these little dollhouses has clues, really subtle clues embedded within it. And so if you study it, study the scene very carefully in her precise way that she laid out, you would be able to find out what really happened. And maybe something that looked like a suicide was actually a murder, or something that looked like a murder was actually an accident. And so if you just went on your first assumptions, the wrong person could be convicted or could go free. And the idea was to reshape the way that police officers looked at crime scenes by using these dollhouses as training tools.
It's interesting how you mentioned when you used to live in Baltimore for a time and you had heard rumors about these dioramas. And so I'm wondering, what did you know about her life? And talk about your kind of maybe the personal connection you felt to her, because you did kind of go through a phase, it seems like, where you were interested in detective stories. You liked Harriet the Spy, for example. You started reading Patricia Cornwell novels when you were, seventh grade, or you were 12 or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I really, there was a strong part of me that has, and probably still does, identify with that detective figure just as she did. I think if you're an introvert, it's a really appealing role. It's the idea that you can, if you sort of lurk outside the social scene, but pay attention to it, you'll see things that nobody else will. It's kind of an introvert's fantasy of power, in a way. The idea that you can be outside and above, sort of like looking at a dollhouse, right? You're outside and above the scene and seeing everything in a complete way that people inside of it can't see. And she certainly seemed to have a little bit of that fantasy of omniscience. Although I really didn't know much about her at all when I first visited the Nutshells, her models in Baltimore 10 years ago. I just knew that they were there, and they've only been on public view once a few years ago in Washington D.C. But usually you have to kind of sneakily arrange an excuse to see them, and so they're not easy to gain access to.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is that one of the characteristics of the women that you profile is that their interest in crime allowed them to express things they couldn't otherwise express. What was that for Frances? What was the thing that she couldn't otherwise voice, do you think?
Well, she's such a funny person because she, in some ways, was so privileged, but was frustrated her whole life, did not have access to the education that she wanted, and therefore didn't have access to a career, never really felt taken seriously. And so even as she self-educated herself in the field of forensics to the point that she was really one of the foremost experts in the country, she was never quite taken seriously. She funded one of the first departments of legal medicine, which later became forensic pathology, in the United States, in part because she wanted to suggest experiments. She wanted to build a lab. She wanted to just really get in there, and Harvard really preferred her to be a rich lady who gave them money and then shut up. And she didn't want to be that, but there was not a space for her. And so I do think that building a dollhouse is a way of constructing a world that you have control over, right? And so it's hard not to see that reflected in the models that she made. Here was a way that she could have agency, have control, do something really ambitious at this shrunken scale. But this was the world where she could do what she wanted, even as she couldn't maybe in the rest of the world.
Let's talk about Lisa Statman, another one of the women you profile in the book. And I guess her story begins, at least your interest in her story begins when she moves into this guest house in Beverly Hills in 1990. It's the guest house on the property where Sharon Tate and others were murdered by the followers of Charles Manson in 1969. She gets really obsessed by this idea of victims, I guess.
Yeah, so according to Lisa Statman, she, and this is disputed, but according to her, she didn't know about this property's history when she moved in. It was just a random coincidence. But by all accounts, it seems that shortly after she moved in, she became involved with this world of researchers. They often describe themselves as kind of amateurs who are fascinated with the Manson family and the case, and trying to figure out if there was a conspiracy, if there are things that haven't been uncovered about that story yet. And through a complicated series of events, she becomes close with Sharon Tate's sister, and they end up moving in together and becoming domestic partners. And through this, she becomes involved with the victims' rights movement, which Sharon Tate's family, her mother primarily, had been a huge driver of in the decades after her daughter was murdered.
There are a number of things in this part of the book that I wanted to ask you about. One of them is this kind of, I don't know, and we all have this inclination to kind of gawk at places where tragedies happened. I mean, you mentioned yourself going by Columbine High School. And there was this moment when you kind of went out of your way to get there, and there's a lot of traffic at the time, and you felt kind of ashamed of yourself, you mentioned. And you talk about this line, that line between honoring a tragedy and yet feeding off it as well. Talk a little bit about that, what you now understand about that line, having written this book and explored it like this.
You know, I don't know if that's something that I found an answer of, but it's I guess a question that seems really important to keep in mind. I think these stories that center on victims and the pain of victims can be incredibly cathartic in a way, I think, for people who have themselves been victims in some way, to empathize with somebody else's pain. And it can feel almost reparative, I guess, mm-hmm. to when somebody reading a story about something terrible that somebody else has gone through, and to try to feel your own pain as a way to connect with them, as if that maybe will help mitigate the tragedy in some way, or at least, you know, not let their pain be forgotten. But at the same time, it certainly can tip over into being exploitative, or being almost like greedy in a way. It's taking somebody else's tragedy as your own. And I don't know what that line is. I'm not sure if there's like a clear diagnostic test, but it does seem to me really important to at least ask that question. You know, is this for me, or is this for them? And it's okay if it's for yourself, but it's just sort of being honest about what that fascination is.
Well, I got the sense that for Lisa, she got really defensive when anyone would say it was not anything other than her just interest in victims. And the interest of Sharon and the other victims, she just wouldn't hear of it, it seems. Part of this was about herself, not just the victims themselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I want to be careful about speculating about, you know, what goes on in anybody else's head and what the motivations are or anything. But I do think that that's a pattern that you see over and over again. And it has come to really trouble me. You see politicians do this all the time, a way of using victims as almost a shield. When a person claims to be speaking on behalf of victims in general or a particular victim, then they become, in a way, uncriticizable. You can't critique their motives or whatever they're advocating for, because in that way you are critiquing the victims.
You write about your own fascination with a victim. You tell the story about Taylor Beale. She was a girl who went missing at Virginia Commonwealth University. This was back in 2005. And you write about following the story when you yourself were in college. Talk a little bit about this part, if you would, because one of the things you mentioned, this I keyed on this sentence, you said, my fascination with that story felt lonely. What did you mean by that?
Well, part of that was at the time in 2005, there wasn't necessarily this robust internet infrastructure that we have now. True crime, we're in this booming true crime era, but in 2005, I didn't know where to go on the internet to get more information. I was just reading news articles, and I didn't quite feel like, it felt like there was something unseemly about my interest in this case. And so it felt private. It was something that I kept to myself. And it was another example of that, the crime funk that you mentioned earlier, when I would feel my own, it was something that I turned to when I, in my own depression or alienation or feeling out of sync with the world in some ways, I would just read about Taylor and think about what could have happened to her. She was missing for a few weeks before her body was eventually found. And sort of imagine myself in her place in a way.
Yeah. You describe it as a troubling pleasure in thinking about how I could have been her or she could have been me.
Yeah, and I think that was ultimately where I kind of became disturbed in a way with my own interest in her. And I realized that my interest in her had more to do with myself than it had to do with her. And once I admitted that to myself, I felt like I couldn't quite have the same obsessive relationship. It didn't sit right in the same way.
I wanted to ask you about, you've said that one of the themes that, and maybe this was surprising, I'm not sure, but that has emerged in the book for you was just how, as you've put it, technology shapes these obsessions, which is going to get us to the story of Lindsay Savannarath. But talk a little bit about that part, the technology part. Did that surprise you?
It was really fascinating to learn about how these different communities centering on crime investigation, have sprung up and have used various aspects of media over time. I mean, I remember talking to somebody who was involved in the Manson researcher community, and it used to be so difficult back in the days before the internet to get information that wasn't just what was in the newspapers and in the magazines. There would be ads in the back of magazines, like, you know, a little like right away, write to us and send us, you know, $5 and we'll send you transcripts or crime scene photographs or something like that. And then with the internet, we saw this huge growth in just the access to both primary source information. So you could, you know, listen to the 911 call yourself, read the court transcripts yourself, and then also these communities that sprung up where people, it's kind of the opposite of that lonely feeling of reading about a case and feeling like you're the only one in the world who cares about it, as people find community, they form friendships of a kind with people all around the world in some cases who share the same interest in a case that might not have impacted their own lives, but somehow drew them in.
Hmm. Let's talk about Lindsay Savannarath. She's from the suburbs of Chicago. You describe her in the book as a dreamy kid who lived in her head and on the computer. And it's interesting that she becomes obsessed with the Columbine murders. But when she first heard about the story, she was terrified about it, scared her for days, you say. And she goes through this transition. I think it was in middle school you mentioned how where things get, you know, at first she's interested in like Harry Potter and fantasy stuff, and then it gets really, really dark. She gets, and speaking of technology, starts to gravitate to these edgier internet forums you mentioned. Tell us about Lindsay, if you would. What interested you in her story?
Yeah, so she was one of these kids that I think we're seeing more and more of these days who really grew up with and on the internet. She was just sort of socially awkward, had a hard time meeting friends in real life, but she's very bright and very funny. And so online, where she could maybe manage or control her appearance and her affect a little bit more, that just felt more like home to her. And like you mentioned, when she was younger, that involved these kind of more harmless fantasy escapist online communities. But then as she grew older, it really got a lot darker. And at the time that I'm primarily writing about, she's graduated from college. She's living at home with her parents. She doesn't have a job. She applies for the Peace Corps, but she gets rejected. She doesn't know really what she's going to do with her life. She doesn't have very many friends in real life, no friends in real life, and is spending more and more time online. And that world seems much more real to her. And if in real life she presents as this very kind of meek, quiet, unobtrusive young woman, online she's involved in these communities where she's very brash, very arrogant, and very obsessed with violence. And so you see this great divergence in who she is online and who she is in IRL, as we would say. And it seems like she sort of grows to identify much more with her online persona. And this gets expressed in some ways through this online community devoted to the Columbine shootings, which she becomes drawn into and really fascinated by.
Let's talk about that online sort of subculture, the Columbiners. You write this, that this world, the Columbiner world, you say was creepy, but unexpectedly familiar. What did you mean by that?
What was unexpectedly familiar, I guess, was the way that this was primarily young women in this community, young girls, often like teenagers, preteens, and they were using the language and the cadences of internet crush speak often, which you would typically hear, you know, people talking about, I don't know, Justin Bieber or One Direction. Instead of talking about cute pop stars, they were talking about the Columbine shooters. And so it was this very disconcerting world where this kind of bubbly, giddy teen girl energy mixed with this like really dark, nihilistic interest in violence, and they had been written about a little bit before, and usually the people writing about them were just sort of shocked and horrified, and that seemed to me almost too obvious of a response. Like that's exactly what they were going for, right? These girls online, they knew that they were being shocking. They knew that they were trying to freak people out, and so there was a strong part of me that was like, well, I refuse to. I'll be shocked. But I don't want to stop there. I want to kind of go beyond and think about it. Like, okay, well, what might they be trying to say? Because when I thought about my own adolescence and my own the really insanely intense crushes that I would get in eighth grade, usually they weren't really about the person that I had a crush on, who was often like pretty banal in retrospect. They were something about myself that I couldn't quite own or say out loud. And so it seemed to me that when you have this big subset of girls fawning over school shooters, what they were really talking about was their own feelings of alienation or rage, experiences of being bullied. But it's they maybe didn't feel the space to claim that themselves. And so they were projecting it onto these boys and saying, I love this boy who was violent and angry and alienated, instead of owning it themselves.
You mentioned in the book that You say that we are overestimating our capacity to understand these stories. I wanted to ask you about that because you mentioned how there's an opportunity now to be more honest about our own appetites and more curious about them. But it's pretty hard to go there for a lot of us. So just explain what you mean, if you would.
I think that, at least for myself, I have wound up just wanting to keep asking questions and to not be satisfied with easy answers, not be satisfied with easy stories, stories of good guys, clear good guys and clear bad guys. You know, sometimes people have asked me, is all true crime bad, or is there some sort of litmus test that can help us sort out what is good and what is bad? And I think that's in some ways a mistaken question. I think these stories are appealing because they do take us into the shadowy parts of our psyches and of our culture, and that we shouldn't, and that by trying to make it clean or virtuous or easy, we're sort of missing the point. But I do think that we just have to be vigilant as and critical consumers of media and not buy easy stories of villains or simplistic stories of victims, and that by and really look at ourselves and wonder what satisfaction we are getting from these stories and admitting that there's satisfaction there. I think that'll make us, as consumers of media, just less able to be manipulated and less less sort of passive consumers and more active consumers, I guess, is what I'm hoping.
It's interesting. You, by the final night of this experience, you write about it, CrimeCon, you say that things had changed, that when you went back to your room to turn on the TV, that the familiarity, you say, of those crime show formulas didn't feel as comforting as they had before, and that you started to feel claustrophobic, I think is how you put it, and overly familiar. What was going on there?
Yeah, I think that the more that I thought about these tropes and looked at these tropes and the way these stories are, at least in some forms of pop culture, shaped to hit these familiar beats and tell us the same story over and over again, just sort of with different content, the more I became frustrated, I think, with the simplicity of those stories and the more I became curious about what was being left out of the frame. What wasn't I being told? I knew there was more going on. And so these stories, which I think used to lull me, I mean, that was a real, these true crime stories, I think, can have a narcotic effect in a way. You listen to people talk about turning on Forensic Files, turning on Investigation Discovery, turning on, you know, Law and Order SVU. That's not true crime, but they're often based on true stories and leaving and just zoning out for hours. And I found myself unable to kind of get into that state of hypnotic state, I guess, in the same way. And ultimately, I think that's good because I kept thinking, you know, I know there's a lot that's being left out here. I know that I'm being, in some ways, manipulated. And so the power of that, the power to be hypnotized and lulled and sucked in, it kind of broke. I don't know if I, you know, when you like eat the same meal too many times in a row and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I could never eat that again. Even if it used to be your favorite. That's kind of what happened to me. And so it's not that these stories still don't interest me, but there's something about that going into that almost narcoticized state. It just doesn't happen in the same way. My brain is always kind of thinking about what's left out. What am I not hearing? How is this being simplified? What are they not telling me?
Rachel Monroe, Her new book is Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Radio West is a production of KUER, thanks to our intern Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombart and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.